Hello everybody, here is Luca on CJSF 90.1, broadcasting from Barnaby, BC. Stay tuned and enjoy!
Speak up. You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Welcome to Speak Up. It is Tuesday, April 7th. My name is Magnus, and in a few minutes joining me will be Robin, and we'll be talking about some interesting online events and workshops that you can take advantage of from home. A little later in the program, we'll also be talking about some of the numbers related to the ongoing COVID-19 situation in Canada and elsewhere. And some of the other information coming out particularly the plethora of charts you'll be you see if you look into this at all, and how you might be able to better interpret them. Later in the program, we'll be bringing you Front Burner, if we have time, and it's an update for today, looking at COVID-19 and the overdose crisis, and how those two things come together. First off, though, we have the daily news, pandemic news wrap-up from brought to you by the BBC.
This is the coronavirus global update on Tuesday, the 7th of April. I'm Henry Bellow. The British Prime Minister has been moved to intensive care at a London hospital. Refrigerated containers store the dead in New York City, and should face masks be reserved for medical staff only? Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has spent another night in hospital, this time in an intensive care unit after his symptoms worsened. The 55-year-old was given oxygen on Monday afternoon, but he has not been placed on a ventilator. Our political correspondent is Rob Watson.
This feels like a grave moment for Mr. Johnson, his family, his government, and the whole country amid what nobody disputes, I think, is the most serious national emergency since the Second World War. And at such a time, a nation and its people look to their leaders. But in Britain, their leader is in intensive care.
The Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab will deputise for Mr. Johnson while he remains in intensive care. Many world leaders have passed on their best wishes, including the U.S. President Donald Trump.
Americans are all praying for his recovery. He's been a really good friend. He's been really something very special, strong, resolute, doesn't quit, doesn't give up.
But the president's main concern will be the tenfold rise in deaths in New York, where hospital mortuaries are now full and refrigerated trailers are storing the deceased. The mayor, Bill de Blasio, says it could soon be necessary to build graveyards in public parks.
If we need to do temporary burials to be able to tide us over to pass the crisis and then work with each family on their appropriate arrangements, we have the ability to do that.
The number of dead across the entire country has now passed 10,000. Dr. Uzma Syed is an infectious disease expert who works across three hospitals in New York. She says her colleagues are bracing themselves for the worst.
The situation is very quickly and rapidly evolving, and we have a very high volume of patients that we are seeing. We're fortunate enough to have the supplies that we need, but the numbers of people that are coming to the hospitals that are ill, you know, the concern is how long will these supplies last?
We know that face masks are essential for medical professionals to protect themselves in hospitals, but there is a global shortage of protective equipment, and the head of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, says doctors must be prioritized.
We're concerned that the mass use of medical masks by the general population could exacerbate the shortage of these specialized masks for the people who need them most.
The Brazilian Health Minister, Luiz Henrique Mandetta, says he'll keep trying to save lives, despite rumours he may be fired by President Jair Bolsonaro. The minister has clashed with Mr. Bolsonaro, who's been seeking to limit Brazil's current strategy of social distancing to the elderly and the vulnerable because of concerns over damage to the economy. Meanwhile, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development says it's a false dilemma for governments to put economic concerns before stopping the pandemic. The OECD Secretary General is Angel Gurria.
You deal with the virus, you deal with the enemy, and then it'll be easier to get out of the problem later.
In Africa, some governments are imposing stricter measures to slow the spread of the disease. All travel in and out of the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, will be banned for 3 weeks. Zimbabwe has warned people to stop selling COVID-19 test kits unless they are approved by authorities. And in the Ivory Coast's commercial capital, Abidjan, protesters have destroyed a coronavirus testing clinic, arguing it was too close to a crowded residential area. The coronavirus has left millions of people unemployed worldwide, but in Italy, a proposed wage cut for top football players has been dismissed by their union as shameful. There is no consensus on how much some of sport's highest earners should sacrifice, as Alex Capstick explains.
A similar proposal by the Premier League in England was rejected. Owners will instead make their own arrangements with squad members. It's the same situation in Germany and in Spain, where Barcelona and Atletico Madrid have agreed to 70% pay cuts.
There are fewer than 1,000 confirmed cases in New Zealand and just one recorded death, but the country remains under strict lockdown. The Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has this message for children worried about some of the restrictions.
You'll be pleased to know that we do consider both the Tooth Fairy and the Easter Bunny to be essential workers. But as you can imagine at this time, if they're going to be potentially quite busy at home with their family as well and their own bunnies. And so I say to the children of New Zealand, if the Easter Bunny doesn't make it to your household, then we have to understand that it's a bit difficult at the moment for the bunny to perhaps get everywhere.
This is the Coronavirus Global Update.
All right, thanks to the BBC for that report on the world situation. Joining me online here, or on the telephone here, because we're practicing our safe physical distancing here at CJSF, is our programming coordinator, Robin Erickson. Hello, Robin.
Hello. Greetings from home.
it's interesting doing all this programming in this way. I know... we here at CJSF have been ramping up our efforts to get our many volunteers programming from home. And of course, if you've been watching TV news on at all, and some of the other broadcasters, everyone else is doing the same thing. We, of course, I think, have an extra challenge in that we have so many people. And we by no means have, you know, the equipment that we can just lend everybody what they need to do it from home. But people are stepping up. It's an interesting model, modern world we're living in with respect to that. And it certainly makes it a little easier than, say, 10 years ago or 15 years ago to try and do the similar thing. How have our programmers been... doing with their efforts?
I think very well, all things considered. You know, we have so many volunteers who have different skill levels also in terms of what their technical know-how is, what kind of setup they're comfortable with at home, and people are really taking it to heart to step up to the challenge. So I think, you know, last week we saw a few more people producing from home. And this week, hopefully, we'll see a few more producing from home. And, you know, it's variable in terms of how people are figuring it out because we're not there in the station where people can come and just ask us questions in person. And And so, yeah, it's a lot of kind of what we stand for, right? That that real DIY, figure it out, you know, hands-on broadcast. And some of it might feel and sound a little rough over the first little while, and we certainly appreciate listeners' patience while we figure all of these things out. But, you know, that's also part of what I love about community radio is that it does have this sort of edgy, almost raw quality where you can tell that it's made by real humans.
And now real humans working in somewhat extraordinary circumstances. One of the biggest challenges people have at home is, of course, here at the radio station, we have all this professional equipment and, $500 microphones and mixing boards and all, multiple computers that you can be playing things off, switching between different things. You know, even in the course of this show, I'm, working from, and this is a fairly simple show. We got you on the telephone and, a few audio files to play. And, I have three or four different programs I'm working with and two computers and all this gear. And people at home have to, they got one computer and they have to make it all happen on the one computer and, figure out what they can do for a microphone, which is often the biggest challenge. Do you do it? Do you have a headset? Do you have the mic in your laptop? Which, of course, was never intended for broadcast radio. Mm-hmm. But it works. It was, I've heard a few of the shows now and they definitely sound a little different. But people are there. Producing new programming. And one thing that is good, when they're playing music, that's one of the easiest things to get onto the recording with the good quality. Because everything else, as long as you can hear someone talking and clearly make out what they're saying, it's good. But if the music didn't sound good, it wouldn't be pleasant at all. And that part of it really does seem to work well. And really, so it's exciting to see people starting to get that happening at home.
Yeah.
All right. I just want to just quickly talk about a couple things to do with numbers, and I don't want to spend too much time on this because what's happening in the world on this, mostly because if you start throwing too many numbers out, it just gets a little baffling. But I've been trying to go through numbers, and there are lots of resources online to track the numbers to see how we're doing and what we can expect coming up. And so I've been looking through things and the most interesting thing I'm looking at is comparing a number of countries to where they are in the course of the pandemic in their countries, comparing either to the first day of having 100 cases, which seems, and then tracking the progress of cases from there, but also tracking the deaths. And one thing that's encouraging is that, fortunately for us here in Canada, we've been doing pretty well comparing to, because we're today on, it's 28 days yesterday since the first recorded death in Canada.
Okay.
And seems like a year ago, doesn't it?
It does.
I can barely see back that far in time to remember when they were talking about that first death, which happened here in Vancouver, I believe, at the Lynn Valley Care Center was the first one in BC, and things have gone on since then. Since then, as of yesterday, we've had 323 deaths here in Canada. And to put that into perspective, I talked about this 2 weeks ago, we were at 24 deaths, and a week ago we were, I think, at 96. So you can sort of see how the trend is going. Each week, the number exceeds everything that came before it, which is, and then some, which is a frightening prospect. But compared to some other countries, we're not doing bad. Other countries, such as the UK, we had our, let me see here, We had our first recorded death on March 9th. In the UK, they had their first recorded death on March 5th. And on 28 days after March 5th, they were at 2,921 deaths compared to our 323.
Wow.
Yeah. Other countries, even these are the ones you hear about. I probably should have picked and maybe next time I talk, some different samples because it's easy to... Anyway, you know, Italy, 4,000 deaths on the 28th day after the first death. And Spain, 8,464 deaths on the 28th day. So as bad as we're... As scary as it is to watch the numbers go up, and as awful it is for the families affected, we are doing pretty well here in Canada. And I think that is reason to look at all the things we're doing and, you know, the sacrifices we're making. And for many of us, you know, that biggest sacrifice is just staying home. Certainly that's the case for me. We're lucky at this stage. You know, we haven't lost our work or had our hours cut back, so we're not affected that way. Many people have seen, you know, lost a lot of work or all their work. But the sacrifices we are making, both individually and as a society, do seem to be paying off. The other thing I wanted to talk about just briefly before moving on is one of the things, and it, I think, reinforces that point of the importance of continuing to do the social distancing, the physical distancing, the staying home, the minimizing our contacts with people outside of our immediate household. One of the things you look at when you look through all the different charts and stuff and information, most often it's put into charts because that really makes clear what's going on. And two particular charts you see mostly are ones that track a certain statistic across time, whether it's the number of cases across time or the number of deaths across time. And then there's other ones that track who's recovered and stuff. And then they do that in two ways. One is where you track the cumulative totals across time. And one where you tap the individual totals for each day, and you can look at all those. And one type of chart you see is the linear chart, and that's where the scales on both axes of the chart are just count up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and then, you know, the dates cross the bottom. And those are pretty easy to understand. You can look at the numbers and see... what's happening. You can see that, you know, for instance, if it's tracking daily totals, you know, where numbers are increasing each day, or it's when it's tracking cumulative totals, you can see where things start, you know, these ones often look quite frightening because you see the numbers starts flat and gets steeper and steeper and steeper as we go. And those are pretty straightforward. I mean, people are used to looking at numbers in that way. The other charts you see are what are called logarithmic charts. And this is where, usually on the bottom scale, you'll have the dates again, because it's easier tracking it against dates. But on the vertical scale, what it has is a scale that, with even spacing, goes 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000. And those are a little harder to understand. What's going on, and I'm not really going to get into the explanation too much because it's super difficult to do without, at the very least, a bunch of charts and diagrams to explain. But whereas the linear charts are really just tracking numbers, either numbers each day, and you can see how things are increasing or decreasing, or the cumulative numbers where everything's sort of added together as you go, to see that, you know, how the total of affected people is increasing. The logarithmic charts are taking and looking at the data in a different way, and what they're tracking and what you can take away from them is that they're tracking the rate of change in whatever statistic is being measured, whether it's the number of cases per day or number of cases or the number of deaths or whatever. It's tracking the rate of change in that statistic. So, you know, if it's the number of cases, how fast are the number of cases increasing each day? And what you can take, the easiest thing you can take away from those charts is as simple as this, that the steepness of the line on that chart represents that rate of change. The steeper the line, the faster that increase is happening. The lower that line, the lower that line, the slower that's happening. And what we're seeing for COVID-19 is that, for the most part, that rate of change for both the increase in cases and the increase in deaths is, in almost all countries, is between a doubling rate of either doubling every 3 days to doubling every 4 days. So the faster it is increasing, the faster it doubles, the steeper that line is going to be. So when you look at those charts, that's what you're seeing. And you can, that line on those logarithmic charts is telling you the change, the change in that rate as time goes on. It's pretty significant what it means in terms of those changes. Certainly, I was looking at today where here in Canada we're kind of in the middle. We're at about three. The rate of doubling is about every 3.5. Other countries where it's been much worse, it's up closer to 4. And then you can see really hopeful cases such as South Korea. One of the first countries affected after China, where they put in a lot of measures, and you look at their rate, and it's really flattening off. You know, instead of being a curve sloping up through the graph, it starts curving to flatten out. And the significance of those differences, I just did a quick calculation on. We're on day 28 here in Canada, and if you're at a rate of doubling every 4 days, in 28 days you'll have doubled 7 times, which from starting at 1 gets you to 128 people affected. In this case, approximately, let's say, deaths. If you're doubling every 3 days, you'll have doubled more than 9 times in that same period of time, meaning that you're over 512 deaths. So it's really different, the significance of this. If we stretch it out another month, you know, to 56 days or 8 weeks, you would get, at doubling every 4 days, you'd get over 16,000 people affected. If you're doubling every 3 days, you get 262,000 people affected. And this is where, you know, everything we do in terms of all the social distancing we do is so, so important. Because when it comes to flattening this curve, you know, it's not the government doing it and it's not the health authorities doing it, although they're doing the hard work of making sure we all know what we need to be doing. It's what every single one of us is doing to minimize the spread that starts bringing that numbers down. And they're reporting here in BC, as of yesterday, they're actually seeing enough of a trend that they really feel they're starting to see those numbers coming down, that rate coming down, and our curve actually flattening. So, go ahead.
I was just going to say that's really exciting news, but I also worry in some ways that, you know, when we see the curve flattening and we feel like we're out of the woods a little bit, that we're going to let our guard down in a sense and start doing things that we normally want to be doing, you know, mm-hmm. socializing and going out without masks and, you know, just, you know, doing non-essential kinds of things. And I think this is really where we have to emphasize that this is the time that we need to be almost extra vigilant mm-hmm. in our efforts, because it's one thing to see the curve flattening, but it's also a different thing to keep it going on that downward trend. And that's going to take still that physical distancing until we're at zero in terms of numbers.
Yeah, the work it takes to flatten that curve isn't an achievement. It isn't like we get to a goal and then poof, we've done it. It is a process. It is,
yeah,
is going to be the ongoing persistence of sticking with what we're doing, you know, until the danger is passed. And I guess the scary thing about that is they're not quite sure when that is yet. Just before we move on, I just wanted to mention that if you're interested in getting a better understanding of these logarithmic charts, because it's actually really important information and the implications of what you see there. I mean, when we talk about these numbers, 16,000 versus 262,000 for doubling 3 days to doubling 4 days is huge numbers. Because that's where we, you know, if nothing was being done and numbers just kept going, like, that's where we'd be going, for instance, with deaths. And that's not what anyone wants to see. There's a great resource that you can find online that has an excellent explanation of how logarithmic charts work and what they mean. It is at www.datawrapper.de, and that's data wrapper with a W, like wrapping something up, datawrapper.de/weeklychart-logscale. And it goes through the whole, in very layman's language, with diagrams and really good explanations if you're looking for a deeper understanding of these charts that you're going to be seeing everywhere and you want to understand just what you're looking at, because if you're unfamiliar with it, it's interesting to see the lines moving around, but if you're not quite sure what they mean, it's hard to understand. So we here in Campus Radio have all pretty much across the land now, everyone's closed their stations to just the minimum staff coming and accessing, and people are all across the land trying to do their programming from home. You're also connected to our sister station in Winnipeg, CKUW, and they've had a big development in their environment. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, because I used to be a staff and volunteer at CKW, I'm still on the email list of volunteers there, and I just got an email that the station manager has been, you know, like we have, sending messages to our programmers and volunteers about what's going on and how to sort of navigate this time as community broadcasters. And at the University of Winnipeg, they've officially closed the university until September, and limited access to the university in its entirety to essential staff, period. So for the radio station there, CKUW, what that means is that the programmers won't be allowed back in until after September, and it's just the essential staff, which is, you know, two full-time people and two part-time people, doing the work to keep everything kind of ticking along, which of course adds a bunch of complications in a way. You know, we talked about that a little bit at the beginning of the show, how we're trying to get programmers up and to speed with programming from home and making their shows. But, you know, there's going to be people who just don't get on board with that. And that means for listeners, you know, that some of these programs that they've come to rely on and really come to love either don't exist anymore or don't exist in the same way, or that it's just not able for us to deliver fresh content in some instances. So it does change the nature of what you will hear and what we're able to deliver in perhaps a much longer time frame than any of us considered or thought a month ago when this hit.
Yeah, here at CJSF and at SFU, we do know that already for this coming summer, the university has canceled the work-study program. That's a program where, through the financial aid department, where students can get part-time jobs on campus in departments, and we have a number of students who work for the radio station in that capacity. So they've already canceled that program for the summer. We haven't heard more about their plans for the summer semester. But that's definitely something we'll be waiting to see what happens. It's entirely possible that the SFU could also cancel the summer semester. You know, trying to move everything, you know, the entire program online, they've sort of had to do it very quickly to complete this semester, which was at the point of being 80% finished when all this sort of really blew up. But we'll have to, you know, whether that's something they feel they can do and offer students what they need in terms of summer classes is, I guess, something they're figuring out right now. We don't know. But one of the other implications of this for CKUW, and I'm not sure how significant summer enrollment was at the University of Winnipeg, but it's pretty significant here, definitely smaller than the fall and spring semesters. But, you know, our the bulk of our funding comes from a fee levy voted by students, and that is based on enrollment for each semester. So if there's no summer semester, then there would be no fee revenue from that enrollment over the summer. So that's going to be something that will affect CKUW, at least we know now, and any other stations at universities where summer semesters can be dramatically affected, whether it's much smaller than previously or canceled entirely. Obviously, like many, you know, as with many other nonprofits, some of these programs that the government is announcing, like the wage subsidy, and some others will should be ones we can take advantage of to you know, supplement. But it definitely is going to be a hardship for the station, the stations that are affected, if it comes to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely going to be a factor for sure. And you know, as you were saying about the realities of getting a summer semester online for not just SFU but for any of the universities across the country, it's not a matter of just taking what you deliver as in-person content and making it an online course. Like those, that the transference of one thing to another thing isn't as direct. And so, even though the will might be there, just the time frame of being able to do these things in a way that actually delivers the content in a meaningful way that hits all of the academic markers mm-hmm. and standards is another thing completely. So there might be some online offerings for sure, but I don't think we'll see it in the same to the same degree.
And I would think that, you know, for students looking at, you know, students who would normally be considering taking summer courses, you know, they're going to be looking at their student experience, both the academic part of it and the rest of what comes from, you know, going to school and really wondering whether it's even worth it. You know, do I really want to take courses this summer, you know, like this when I, you know, with all this going on and courses that may not really be everything you'd hoped for. So I think there'll be a lot, you know, a lot of students will just look at that and go, well, I think I'll wait till things get back to the normal in the fall rather than take those summer courses. On the other hand, you know, who knows what the summer job market for students is going to be. It's not like they can just, you know, not going to school means working all summer, because that's going to be, I mean, things are just, you know, if things get better, you know, in a couple months and the economy starts returning to normal, you know, businesses are just going to be, you know, ramping up. And so who knows what that kind of situation for students is going to be. And I know there's been some discussion in the news these days about how the current wage and supports that have been announced by the government, for the most part, students don't qualify for those because they either haven't made enough money or they don't have enough hours, or, you know, there's a bunch of things. And so I think there's some discussion about what other thing, how new programs can be made come up for students. But as it is now, I mean, there may not be jobs, and there may not be school, and there may not be jobs for students to take otherwise, and there may or may not be other kinds of supports for students. Because, of course, many students can just go home to spend time with their parents, if, you know, but for many that's not really an option, or not certainly something they had planned to do. You know, they live in the city or wherever they are sort of full-time, and that's how they do it. So a lot of uncertainty for students these days.
For sure.
And I guess a lot of uncertainty for everybody, because we don't know what's going to happen with this summer semester, and, you know, everyone else, so many other people don't know what's going to happen with their job or everything else, so much else in their life.
Yeah.
We're also going to talk about some of the, maybe something a little more brighter after all this doom and gloom talk. It's interesting to see how people in all areas are stepping up to find creative ways to continue to get together without getting together in person, you know, using various online tools. On Friday, I attended an online birthday party where a whole bunch of us got together. This is for my daughter, who's in Victoria right now, and she can't come back to Vancouver unless we want to make a completely unnecessary trip on the ferry, and that just doesn't seem responsible right now. So, you know, a whole bunch of family and friends got together on a video chat, and we did the birthday cake with the candle, and we sang happy birthday, which was interesting because on these video chats, when you're just talking, you don't really notice it, but when you're trying to sing and link up your voices, there's this little bit of latency, which is like maybe a quarter or, you know, it's not much. It's a quarter of a second, half a second. You don't, like I say, you don't really notice it when you're talking, but when everybody's trying to sing the song at the same time, it was interesting, but fun. And it was nice to see a bunch of people. I don't know if you've done anything like that yet, Robin.
I haven't been to a party online, but I've definitely been involved in some just like group chats and group kind of little get-togethers. But I know my sister and her husband have had Friday Friday drinks, Friday cocktails with some friends, where they all get on their devices and have a drink after work. There's all kinds of dance parties. I know virtual dance parties that you know you can log into both for free, but also for you know, a nominal fee, because of course one of the things that this whole situation is really affecting and taking a toll on is artists, you know, and musicians, actors, people who make their living performing in front of an audience. And when that audience isn't able to gather together in one place, you know, people are having to come up with these virtual ways of engaging their fans. And so, yeah, so I've seen a few concerts or concert-like kitchen concerts, I'll call them. Yeah, where people are playing for their fans, and you know, you're encouraged to buy a ticket or donate, you know, put money in the hat, so to speak, over the internet. But I also know that there's you know, things, because part of what we're up against is being at home with ourselves for hours and hours and hours. In some cases, some of us are working from home, and that takes up some of the time. But for those people who aren't working at home and they're just at home with a whole bunch of hours to fill, there are talks and classes and symposiums and virtual engagements of all sorts that existed up until this point that I guess maybe I wasn't aware of, but also ones that are being created just for the purposes of community engagement, because that's one of the things that we need and are desperately craving in some cases.
Yeah, one thing I'm seeing too is people beginning to offer workshops that would, you know, formerly have been an in-person workshop at a location, and now they're doing it through an online meeting of some sorts, and it can be everything from things you normally think would need to be in person, like a yoga class. Lots of yoga teachers are doing what they can to continue to offer, you know, yoga classes and yoga sessions online. And it's interesting when they're online and live like that, because of course, you know, video sessions and webinars have always existed, but you know video ones where they video, go to YouTube and you can watch something and follow along, have been easy to, you know, easy to find for a long time. But it's really different something that's actually happening live right now while you're doing it, but also something you can interact with, because I think both, you know, the education is great, but the interaction is also so important. So things like yoga classes and other sort of physical sort of stuff. I actually have a friend who signed up for a clothing optional yoga class tonight on Zoom, which is a very Vancouver thing to do. So
that's funny.
But there are a bunch of them out there. The Art Gallery of Vancouver is offering a regular series of lectures and talks every week now. Of course, the gallery itself is closed, but they are offering every Tuesday and Friday a series of talks in their Art Connect series. So there's actually one this afternoon, Tuesday, April 7th, at 1:30, with it's a curator's talk with Ashley Connery and Tara Hoag. There's another one on Friday. Is it Howie Sui and Diana Frudel? Hope I'm getting that right. The Kinesthetics of Nature and Durational Sculpting. Now you do visual art practice. Do you know what durational sculpting is?
No. I do not.
So perhaps we should attend this this talk, and then we would find out. Anyway, you can go to the Vancouver Art. Those are the two they have listed now, and I think they're going to keep in their information that you know they're going to be scheduling these more coming up every Tuesday and Friday. The one on Friday is at 4:30. I don't know if those are the regular times all the time. I think you're better off best going to their website.
The one that's today, mm-hmm. I think, is at 1 o'clock.
Yeah, it says 1:30 on their website.
Or 1:30.
Yeah.
I know that there's another curator talk, Kent Monkman, who is Indigenous artist, does a lot of sort of decolonization artwork. That might be a little controversial in the white community, but he's giving a curator talk also through, I think it might be the Museum of Anthropology, and so they've also got these kinds of things. And of course, you know, I've seen also that there's museums around the world mm-hmm. who are opening their collections up online so that people can kind of tour them.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't taken part of any of any of those, but you know, I think especially for people who have that kind of art museum interest, and you know, maybe people with kids who are looking for something a little bit more educational online than just video gamey stuff.
Yeah. Yes, I got an announcement last week from the, I think it was the Art Gallery of Basel in Switzerland, where they had sort of rolled out sort of a whole online program for kids with all, you know, and it was actually, you know, it was obviously something they'd been developing for a while, and I think they sort of accelerated the rollout because of COVID-19 and all the self-distancing. But it was quite a deep program of like lots of different workshops and tutorials and things like that. That was an online, not a live one, but you know, online modules and stuff. Right. But lots of that stuff is happening.
Mm-hmm.
I really did. I don't know. Is there other ones you've heard about?
Not in terms of the online module things.
Yeah. Well, there's another one I heard about called Peak Resilience. It's a free COVID-19 support group, and it's called Building Resilience and Connection in Times of Uncertainty. Peak Resilience is an organization down at the 312 Center in downtown Vancouver, where we also have a studio. And they are having a live session tomorrow at noon, and of the support group, where you can log in online and then participate in the group activity, which sounds really great if you're someone who's you know, struggling with, you know, this social isolating thing, or just bothered by it. I mean, I think we're early in it yet. But you can go to https://all that stuff, peak-resilience.com. And I think if you go there, you do a bit of searching, the rest of the URL is extremely long, and I won't spell it all out. But that's peak-resilience.com. And look for the Building Resilience and Connection in Times of Uncertainty workshop, and you can sign up for that. That's happening tomorrow at 12 noon Pacific time.
Nice.
Yeah.
I know that there are other organizations and even counselors who haven't been able to necessarily see clients in the same way, but recognize that people might be feeling a certain level of anxiety about this, and that could be for all kinds of reasons, you know, isolation, job loss, relationship, you know, just that intimacy of being in relationship in, mm-hmm. in such close quarters all the time can be creating tension for people. And so there are all kinds of offers, I think, in group and individual settings for people to just be able to manage their emotions about what we're in this situation. And, you know, of course, I'm a big fan of art and the power of art and creativity. And it really warms my heart to see all kinds of art-based workshops and things out there. And one of the things that I know was quite a popular out in the community activity were these paint nights, mm-hmm. you know, where you'd pay your $25 or $40 or whatever, and you'd get a glass of wine and some instruction, and everybody would paint. Mm-hmm. You can do that online now in a virtual way. So I guess you would just order maybe what you need from Michael's and mm-hmm. pick it up curbside and then be able to participate in the paint night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing that's challenging is because all this has come up so quickly and there's been so many things we've all needed to deal with and cope with, is that at this point anyway, it's not that easy to find out about some of these, particularly the live workshops that are happening. I really tried to sort of search around on Google to find more that I could talk about. And it isn't easy because, of course, you know, the way their algorithm work, you end up finding a ton of information about workshops that have been canceled or are past. Or, anyway, so it's not that easy to find online. So if you do hear about them, make sure you share them with your friends. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you could maybe email us about them. We'd like to hear about them. And hopefully, you know, I'm sure somebody, you know, one of the things that's interesting to see in these times, how various people sort of pull together and put together a resource about this or a resource about that, you know, pop up a quick website and start adding resources. And hopefully someone will do that for local resources like this to start making it easier to discover them. We're sort of lucky here at the radio station because we get notices from some of the organizations that are putting these on saying, hey, this is happening. But hopefully something like that'll come along. And certainly Facebook and other social media is a good place to look. People are circulating information about these kind of activities there as well.
Yeah, it's for those people who don't necessarily have the access to social media or don't use social media in the same kind of connective ways, where I think that disconnect might happen with trying to figure out, you know, what are these events and how can I sort of engage. One of the things just quickly that I want to mention, just I know we're getting to the top of the hour here in Democracy mm-hmm. Now! Is coming up at 11 o'clock as usual. But, you know, seniors and people who are in vulnerable populations and living in, you know, institutionalized settings, who are completely blocked off and isolated from contact and being able to have any visitors, One of the things that is being asked of us is, you know, if we have time, write a letter, draw a picture, send a little voice note to some of these homes or to prisons or, you know, like I said, anywhere that has people who are institutionalized for whatever reason, because they're really feeling it. I know my grandma, you know, we have a check-in regime between my dad and his wife and my sister and I, so that every day she gets someone talking to her. Otherwise, it's just the TV, right? And how crazy-making is that?
And, of course, seniors in particular are especially isolated because they're the most vulnerable.
Right, yeah.
You know, so even in many ways going outside to do chores and things you just have to do to the grocery store are really not even a good thing for them to be doing. So they're particularly isolated.
No, and for a lot of them, like in my grandma's case, she's not at liberty to move around, you know. She can't leave her room.
So one of the things that's happening tomorrow is it's the International Day of Pink, which is a day of solidarity with LGBTQIA+ and Two-Spirited. And that was, you know, normally it'd be a day when people would be asked to wear pink or participate in a variety of activities to show your support for the LGBT. I always get stumbled at the end of T. I have to look. Here it's 2SLGBTQIA+, the community. And of course, as we know, that's a community that still needs a ton of support and solidarity. So they're still having their a virtual Day of Pink tomorrow. With a whole bunch of activities, and that's something you can try and participate in too. Just looking for their website. Well, you can go to dayofpink.org. That's their website, dayofpink.org. And they have more information there about how you can continue to show your support on for the LGBTQ+ community during the pandemic. So, and you know, I think as much as we can, you know, let's try and get out and participate in. There's lots of other things. I know that food banks are still looking for volunteers who can participate, and they have a whole setup so you can go down there and volunteer in a manner that's safe and help a really vulnerable population. They have, so it's other things you, and I think probably looking at your local volunteer bureau, whether it's Volunteer Burnaby or Vantage Point or others, will have information about ways you can help. There's also resort like one social media based ones like Coming Together Vancouver, which is COVID-19 Coming Together Vancouver, which is a Facebook group that you can join, and they also have a website with some resources, and they have a thing where you can put in information about help you can offer. Other people can go and put in information about help they need, and then they try and match people together. And that's a great way, you know, you were mentioning just a while ago about people who are shut in and need help. That's a great way to find information about people you can call, because it doesn't just have to be, you know, people you know. It can be other people who are just looking for a little connection. We're just about out of time. Any last words for today, Robin? And we'll.
No, other than just, you know, stay home, do your part,
I saw pictures of the beaches and the seawall still packed full of people. Please don't take us to the point where we are forced to stay inside. Be responsible.